Good afternoon. Thank you. So, last class was the midterm. The TA is making good progress on grading. I need to grade my questions. The plan is to have the midterm be returned during tutorial on Monday and Wednesday of next week. So I plan on discussing solutions to the midterm next week, basically after, you know, as part of handing them back. So I'll try to hand them out during the tutorials and maybe bring the remainder to Tuesday and then hopefully hand out the rest of Wednesday. So next week we will talk about the midterm. We have lots of other material to cover, so I won't dwell on that. I'm going to renumber the lectures. This is really the 15th lecture. The midterm exam does not count as a lecture, so I'll change that. But tutorial 5 is, a lot of you have already done that yesterday. I don't want to say too much about, I want to say a little bit about the tutorial, but I want to talk more about the material behind it and what you should be getting out of it. So what I do want to say is there's a number of things talking here about file systems. What I want you to know there is, so first off, what's a file system? And then, what does it mean to make a file system? And a couple of questions that are coming up which are worth talking about for a few minutes. Physical versus logical size. Some of you are in my office talking about this, but it's actually a pretty straightforward thing. Logical size of a file, that's just you're wondering how many bytes are in the file. That's the logical size. So, and physical is how much space it actually takes up on disk. So one thing, physical is in terms of blocks. Awesome. So you're going to have, ask me later. Wait, no, don't upgrade. I will upgrade later on my own. Just the question I want to have in the middle of the lecture. I hate pop-ups. Anyway, so physical space is, physical size is in terms of blocks, which is a fixed unit of allocation. EXT4 has 4K blocks. Default 4K. So block size for the underlying file system by default in EXT4 is 4K, but a lot of the command line utilities think the block size is 4K, is 1K. So they'll report the number of blocks used, but it'll be in 1K blocks, where in fact it's actually that. So why do I say this? Well, if I go to my desktop here, and I do LSLS, this shows how big these files are here, and this shows how many blocks it takes up. This takes up 12 blocks, and 8,800 bytes. That's a little funny. So I really need to just turn this stuff off. So this is the number of blocks here, but this is not the number of 4K blocks, the number of 1K blocks in LS. So let's see, dash S. So scale sizes by size before printing them. E.g. block size M prints smooths of bytes. So let's see. So say, so if I tell ls the size of blocks, it will then do it in terms of this, and it says, oh, these are all one block in size. That's really dumb. It seems to have scaled everything. Anyway. But you get the idea. Play with this in the tutorial. Just want to talk a little about that. Physical logical. Then what is a file system? The thing to understand when you think about a file system is it's a data structure. It's a persistent data structure. It's a persistent data structure organized around blocks. That's all a file system is. Maps. Names to. And maps hierarchical names to values. You have a file name, it gives you a value. You look it up, that's what a file system does. And you can make all kinds of data structures that would produce this. File systems are a special kind that are designed, you know, to be implemented by putting up blocks, and then they provide a you can open them, you can read them, you can write them, you can close them. That's what a file system is. So, what does it mean to make a file system? You are initializing the data structure. That's what it means to, when you format a disk, you're initializing the data structure on the drive. So we'll talk more about this later after you've all finished the tutorial. But I thought I'd just go ahead and give you this for those of you who maybe had a few questions in your mind. Quick question? Otherwise, the real thing I want to talk about was the kernel. We are finally at the part of the course where we're going to start making the kernel do things. And since we're going to get into kernel programming now, I have to start with warnings. How many of you are using Linux as your main system? Okay, this mostly applies to you all. If you do kernel hacking on your main system, you may destroy your main system. It is possible. It is possible that you will run one command and everything will be gone. So, not saying you shouldn't do it. If you want to do it, it's perfectly fine. Just have good backups. May destroy this. Now, as a computer science student, you should always believe this to be the case. But particularly when you're doing kernel level work. So, since you may destroy your work, have good rsync is a great command for making sure you just, you know, you've got a bunch of files and you want to synchronize it to a remote location. You use rsync and synchronize everything. So you just run an rsync just before you install that kernel code you just wrote. It's a useful thing. I mean, there's lots of other backup solutions, I'm saying. Rsync's a very good one. More just to say, I want to make sure the data I'm working on right now is somewhere else before I run this command. I can talk more, I can explain things of how to do this, but you have been warned. I cannot take any responsibility if you destroy your system and lose projects for other courses or anything else you may actually find valuable.
Do we have any super user privileges on the OpenStack images?
Yes. You have full root access on the OpenStack images. You have to have full root access on the OpenStack images. Otherwise, you could not install a kernel.
So I SSH into access and from there into one of the Micron machines to access my OpenStack machine. But when I tried to just like create a new user or create a directory, they didn't seem to.
Okay, so what does it mean to? So let's go to OpenStack. So I'm just logging in here. My interface is a little fancier than yours, but I'm doing this just to remember my IP address. Remember, the only thing you need to do to be able to connect to the OpenStack systems is you need to know the IP address, and you need to be doing the call to network. So in order to get on the Carlton network, you need to VPN in. If you're on Linux box, VPNing is actually really simple. There's a thing called Open Connect. And it's cuvpn.carlton.ca, and then you give your MyCarlton1 credentials. You may need to install Open Connect, but you just do that and it just works. In the past, I used to have to enter some little password or special something, which was like for the VPN software, but I think this now just works. But otherwise, check if you're running macOS, you're running Windows, you're running iOS, look at the Carlton web pages. They tell you how to connect to the VPN. But once you've done that, you can SSH directly in, and you can access the web interface. That's all you have to be. So why was I doing this? I want to see my instances here, and now, apparently yesterday, a lot of you were trying to do stuff with OpenStack and there were some issues. I asked one of the TAs to check in on that. I'm not sure if that got followed up, but I will. Let's see where. Okay, so let's log into my class one. So here's my IP address here. That's odd. 17. Oh, fine. Ah. Okay, so one of the things you have to remember is when you SSH to it, you have to say the username is Ubuntu by default, and you have to specify your key. And you have to have your key available. It asked me, it figured it out finally. I thought I had unlocked it before, but anyway, here's the system here. Now, if you say I want to add user here, you're saying it doesn't work? Well, first thing is, who am I? I'm not root. I'm Ubuntu. You need to do sudo. Sudo on these VMs does not require a password. That's common in these clouds. Now, as root now, you can do whatever you want. Now, if you just want to do a specific command as root, you can just do sudo and run the command. But if you want a shell and you want to play around as root, then do a sudo su dash. That's the simplest way to just get a root shell. And well, sudo su dash makes sure it's like you're logged in as root. This matters because sometimes if you do things as sudo, it mixes your configuration with root's configuration, and things can get a little weird. So why am I here? Well, let's first go here. Now, I want to, so I've already downloaded the ones.zip file from the website. I need to enable, how do you enable? I know there's a really nice kind of key bindings in bash. Does it say how to... Ah. No, that did not work. Anyway, I will have to look that up later. It's something I set in my command files early on. I'm trying to do Emacs commands, and that's why you see me kind of going, what's going on? Anyway, I downloaded this with a wget. I got these files. I did this here. I typed make. This is all. I installed them all. This is stuff you're going to do in the tutorials. But what I want to point out here is, okay, I downloaded some stuff. I typed make. I built it. What did I actually build? What is this? So I can do I already installed it. That's why. Now I think I can still do this. Good. And now so I have this thing where I access slash dev ones, and I have something that outputs an infinite number of ones. Think of dev ones as just like dev urandom, except instead of random bytes, you get the character one. That's what this module is. We'll look at the code in a little bit, but what I want to talk about is, well, how hard is it to make a program that prints out an infinite number of ones? That's kind of simple. You know, while one, printf, one. You know, I remember like the first programs I used to write were 10, print, hello, 20, go to 10. For those of you who know BASIC. So that's not a complicated thing, but I did this as a kernel module. So what, first of all, what's a kernel module? And then what's this dev thing? What's this file in dev ones? So what's a kernel module? It's code. What makes it different from a regular program?
It modifies kernel functionality.
Okay. You could say any program in some sense modifies the system functionality. So what does that mean, modifying kernel functionality?
It runs in kernel space.
That's the key thing to think about, is when you write a kernel module and you install it into the kernel, that code can do anything. It is more powerful than root. except that you realize root can load kernel modules. But that's how you have to do things in order to do the full power of what you do in a kernel module. You have access to all of kernel memory. You can see everything. You can modify anything. That's why I'm talking about this whole thing of things being dangerous. Normally, if you're doing normal C development, if you mess up a process, okay, that may crash. With kernel development, if you mess things up, you crash your entire system. If you're lucky, it just corrupts memory and the system just crashes hard. If you're unlucky, it also corrupts your file system and you've lost all your data. That's why this is so dangerous, is we're modifying the kernel. Now, say, well, how does this compare to just building and installing a new kernel? Well, in terms of power, you can, in principle, do anything with a module that you can do just by modifying the actual binary of the code. I mean, it's, for a lot of operations, it's harder to do it through a module, but you can do it. Now, this, it turns out a lot of kernel functionality that we think of as core kernel functionality is implemented via modules. How can I see what modules are loaded right now in the currently running kernel? LSMod. These are all the modules that are currently loaded on that VM. And this is a virtualized system, so actually it doesn't need as much code as regular Linux systems because, well, it doesn't have to do real device drivers. You can rely on the whatever system virtualizing it is. So this is actually a reduced case for the number of modules you use. This is a lot of modules. They're doing all kinds of things. I don't know what all these things are that it's doing. It's a lot of code here. You might, in fact, go, wait, why is there so much stuff in modules? Well, part of it is, maybe it's stuff you don't need. The stuff that gets built into the kernel is the stuff that has to always be there while the kernel's running. With modules, you just load them as you need them. Now, it turns out in practice, you just load them all at once, mostly, unless you hot plug hardware. Like you stick in a USB device or something, it may load some modules on the fly. Mm-hmm.
There's a module there named Floppy. Is that from Floppy Disk?
Yes, it is.
Why is it still there?
I don't know. I mean, really, this has to also do with Ubuntu. Could I unload that floppy module and have things work? Very possibly. Now, one thing is that this is running a standard Ubuntu kernel, and the standard Ubuntu kernels have a lot of stuff built in. Best I can figure, the reason that floppy thing is loaded is because the virtual machine provides a fake floppy drive. I think it provides a virtual floppy drive interface. That's my best guess. Actually, we can just do a quick check. KVM. Installing a virtualized floppy disk controller. Because that's all, by the way, the OpenStack systems are running on Linux. The underlying OS is Linux. It's using something called KVM to provide the virtualized machine. So we're running Linux on Linux. Yeah. Works. It's actually surprisingly common. Not everywhere. If you're running Azure, you're running Linux on Windows. If you're running a Linux VM on there, but that's Microsoft. Everyone else is pretty much running Linux systems. So let's get rid of this. So there's all kinds of code here. Oh, like PS mouse. What is PS mouse? That's a mouse interface using the PS2 type interface. Not a USB thing. Remember those little round circular things, the plugs? That's a PS2 style interface. Why is it PS2? Anyone know? This is old trivia for some of you. For all of you. Oh. Anyone know what the IBM PS2 was? The IBM Personal System 2. IBM Personal Systems 2 were released in 1987. These are the computers. So IBM introduced these computers as an attempt to take back the PC market. They did not like the fact that the entire market had decided to make IBM compatible machines that they did not control. So they decided to create a new one, and as part of making the new computers, they had various new standard interfaces. One of those interfaces was the interface used to plug in keyboards and mice. Because before this, there was no standardized interface for plugging in mice other than a serial port. And serial ports leave certain things to be desired, so they instead created the PS2 ports. And the PS2 ports, that's what user keyboards. Only in the last 5 years we started getting rid of these things finally. Now we use USB. But yeah, that's why you see PS mouse. Because the virtual machine provides a PS, mouse interface. I'm curious, does mine? Oh, Minecraft PS mouse too. But my system, my main system does not have the floppy interface. Which is good because this machine definitely does not have a floppy drive. Legacy is part of the world. So we have kernel modules. It's a way of so one problem with the code, anything features that you build in at boot time, that's going to be there forever. When you're writing the kernel, you can't free up that space. So that's one reason to have the modules, because if you have it as a module, you can load it and then you can move it. But in practice, modules are kind of small. So it's, most modules. So, and memory is so big, so it's not so much of an issue. If you're ever doing work on an embedded system, it's more of an issue. Now, a natural question to ask, which you may not have thought about, but you should, is why do we need modules? So if we have separate functionality that we want to run separately, why do we need a separate mechanism? Why do we need to be loading code into the kernel anyway? Why can't the kernel just provide interfaces? And we load all these things. Instead of loading a module, you just run a process. So instead of a bunch of modules loaded, you have a bunch of processes loaded. The kernel has to be good at running processes, otherwise your system wouldn't run well at all. And then you could also restrict the access of the individual modules. If they were inside of a process, it would be all the irregular access controls could be applied to it. Does anyone know what this design is called? If you, instead of loading code into the kernel as modules, you instead run everything as a separate process? Give you a hint. It makes the kernel much smaller. Makes the amount of code that's running in supervisor mode much smaller. This is a microkernel design. When people talk about microkernels, so by having a microkernel, you put all the extra, as much functionality as possible that you normally would have inside the kernel into processes. And you just have various APIs. So you can put your networking code as a user space process, you could put your drivers as user space processes, you could do your file systems as user space processes, and everything would just talk to each other. This is a microkernel design. There are real systems that are like this. Linux, which is actually the predecessor to Linux. It still has a microkernel guy, QNX. Local Ottawa company, if you don't know about QNX. If you like doing kernel hacking, good company potentially to join. Herd. The GNU Herd is also based on microkernel design.
Question. For when you say it was increased security to run modules instead of not processes, don't processes have restricted access though?
No, that's increased security if you run processes, not modules.
Okay.
Modules are inherently less safe because you're adding code to the kernel and that code you add has access to everything.
Right. If
you make a process, you could make a privileged process, but for some things you can make it an unprivileged process and you could restrict access. We have lots of ways of confining processes. Once you install a module, the module is unconstrained. It can do whatever it wants. So a natural thing is, why allow any code to be loaded at all? Why not just keep it all separate? It would increase security. Wouldn't that be great? And there are a number of systems that have done this. The Linux kernel specifically has not taken that approach. Although it is technically possible to turn a lot of things that are in the kernel into user space things. You can make user space file system. You can make user space drivers. You can even do user space networking if you really want to. You can pull things out and not have them loaded to the kernel and reduce the size of the kernel and have them as processes. But that's not the standard architecture. That's not where the usual code is. This is a big, so Linus Torvalds, the original author of Linux, and a famous computer science professor, author of Minix, Andrew Tannenbaum, have a famous flame war, if you look it up, where they talk about microkernels versus monolithic kernels. So what's the big argument against this? It's a couple of them. One, this has not changed. Context switches are expensive. What I mean by context switches? Switching between running processes. Imagine every time you have to read a file, instead of switching into the kernel and coming back, you had to switch in and out of 5 different processes. That is possible because you might have to go into one to go to the file system driver, another to go into the device driver, at least two, but you might have some other ones because you've stacked things. Depends on how you've abstracted things, but you could have to talk to many different processes, and every time you talk to a separate process, you'll have to do a context switch. Much of the research in microkernels has been how to make processes talking to each other fast. But so any trick you do to make a microkernel faster, you can just do it in a monolithic kernel and get even more performance. So, big deal. The other thing is, so many of the systems that you might control. If you get control of them, you already own the system. If you control the file system process, you can access all the files of the system. If you control the device driver for the disk, then you control everything. I mean, you already have so much access. You could always use that access to get more access to another system. So it might put a few hurdles, but not so much to a sophisticated attacker. So the overall security benefit is not so much. It's kind of funny because from a design perspective, the idea of dividing things up nicely just is very appealing. But that's not what we do. So this is just a long way of saying, so instead of dividing things up into processes, the Linux kernel divides it into modules because, yeah, things get complicated. We need to be able to load code in and out, but that code you load in and out has full access.
So like putting everything into processes, wouldn't that also make it slower because you have to do a lot more system calls?
Well, that's exactly it. If you put it all into processes, that's what I mean by context switches. When I say context switches, IPC, I'm saying they have to talk to each other. How do they talk to each other? They're going to be making system calls. Or the reason why I didn't say system calls is because microkernels sometimes have ways that aren't quite system calls in order to communicate. Like they do things like create shared memory. And so the things can, oh, now we can just talk via shared memory and synchronize that way. But those kind of tricks can also be used to talk to the kernel. So, why am I telling you all this about modules? Because for much of the rest of the class, we're going to be playing with Linux kernel modules. Either Linux kernel modules or building the kernel from scratch. Because this is an OS class, and hey, why not change the lowest level of the system you're playing with? Now, the virtual machine I've given you is special because I have built a copy of the kernel in it. So here's the source here. This is the Linux kernel source. It's been built here. I'm going to rebuild it and install a new kernel in a moment. But first, we should change that kernel. Well, actually, just building it right now will change it. So I just want to show you that I've actually built a new kernel. So let's first... Have I done this before? No, okay. I don't think I've done this. So if you do this right here, you can see that this is the kernel here. It gives the date. It says Ubuntu Edicomp 3000, so it's on this VM. And this was back in September as I built this. So now I'm going to do... I have to build the kernel. So the kernel is just like any other program. I have to make it. Make is a standard thing for building complex Unix programs. You've all seen make, right? You see make in 2401. Yeah, sorry. The make here is a heck of a lot more complicated than anything you've seen in 2401. It's a very complex build process. And the normal step, if you look at the README, you'll see in the README, it says things about how you do the make. And so, to configure and build the kernel, build right there. Basically, you do make menu config, make kernel, make modules, module style. So what we do is make like menu config. I don't want to do this right now because it might make the kernel not buildable. So, well, it might make I have to build the whole thing, so I'm not going to do that right now, but I'll show you that after I've done this. So you do a make config because the kernel has lots of options for configuration, and we'll talk about configuration in a moment. Then you do a make. And it goes and builds. So this stuff it has to do every time. And then it should. Come on. Oh, it's building the actual thing. Okay, so that's make. So this right here, this is the actual kernel image right here. VM Linux, and then it has to compress it, and that when it compresses it, it creates a VM linux. V-I-U-L-I-N-U-Z-Z. Just doing that. This VM's a little slower than I was expecting. This is not really building the kernel. And there, so now it's compressing it, and there it made the image. The VZ image is ready, and then it's done. So I built the kernel. Am I ready to install it yet? No. Because what does the kernel need with it? This is just the main kernel. What else do I need? All those modules. I've already built the modules, so it won't actually spend much time building it, but it has to go through this process of checking them all to make sure they're all up to date. So I've done that. And now I have to do sudo make install. And then, there we go, sudo make modules. Those are all the modules that I've built previously. They're now installed. And now, I'll reboot the system. Shutdown, dash R is for reboot. I think you can just type reboot. I always type this. Because the scenes, I could say, actually what's cool is you can say things like 5 minutes. Oh. You can schedule this. Cancel. Okay. So I've told the VM now to reboot. It's gonna reboot. Hopefully it should reboot with my new module. Give it a second. Okay, it's up. And you can see it says everything, but now it says Tuesday, November 7th. So this is the module we just built. So we've installed a new kernel. It's the same kernel as before because we didn't make any changes, but yeah, we installed and built a kernel. Now, let's say I wanted to change the configuration of it. So the actual configuration is in a file called .config. You can just edit this file. If you edit this file, you can change the configuration. You don't want to edit this file directly. Yeah, it keeps going. Instead, you do make menu config. And now you can get a nice little, interface for, editing things. And you can select things and change them and stuff, and we can say exit. We're not going to save this. Is this, if let's say you have your own system and you want to build your own kernel thing, what configuration should you use? What configuration could you start with? Do you want to try making a configuration that will work on your hardware by yourself, by hand? No, don't do that. I've been doing this for a very long time, and if I try doing it from scratch, I mess it up, and I get a kernel that won't boot. So how do you do it? Well, we fortunately have configurations that are already there. So, well, where did the kernel get installed? Here, /boot. There's your kernels. The main images are these. This is the actual kernel that you're going to load. They're about 6.7, 6.8 megabytes. That's the kernel itself. Where's the configuration? Right here. So you could just copy. When you have a running Linux system, you can just copy this .config to your thing, and then you could run, you know, just use that as the basis. If you run menu config and save, it'll load that in by default. You can type make old config, and it will just build it based upon, you know, build it, you know, doing that, maybe asking some questions if there's any questions that have changed between the kernel version of that and the new kernel. But there's a really cool thing called this is what I was looking for. So these are all the ways you can do this. All mod config. There we go. Local mod config. If you do a make local mod config, it takes the output of lsmod and uses that for configuring the kernel. So you know you have a running kernel with the current modules, the current configuration. So it will figure all that out and configure your kernel that way. So this is a very useful command if you're going on a new system. So a new system that has a working kernel, you just want to build a new kernel from scratch, you say make local mod config, make modules, make install, make modules install, done. That's it. So why are we playing with modules? Because that's still a pain. I'm telling you all this right now, and we'll probably do more of it later. This is the quick version. You can build and install a kernel. You have everything you need to do it. Doing so takes time and effort, and in general, it's much easier if you can put your functionality in a module and just install it there. So let's go back to device files. So do we have dev1s installed? Dev1s doesn't exist. Didn't it exist a second ago? What changed? I made a new kernel, yes. And what else did I do? Not so much the building of a new kernel.
I restarted.
So this is a key concept here, is when you load a module, the module is only there loaded as long as the system is running. You reboot, and the module's gone. All the kernel state's gone. The only way the module will be loaded again is if you add it to a list of modules that are loaded at boot time. And there's a list. If you add it to this list, there's other mechanisms which I have to look up exactly how Ubuntu now decides which modules to load. It used to be I'd just stick them all in here. I think you can still stick modules in here, and so when you reboot it would be there after installing in a standard place. But for now, let's just go to ones. Install module ones.ko. Okay. And now we can see. Probably easier way to do this is to do head. Okay, that didn't work so well. Bytes. Dash C 100. We need to get some bytes for it. What am I What I'm wondering now is, so ones only worked once I load the module. Now it exists. Now, before we even look at the code, what do we want the Dev1's module to do? It has to have some code to allow the module to be loaded. It has to have some code to allow the module to be unloaded. But in order to implement the device file of Dev1's, what do I need to implement? I need to implement the file API. That's all. I have a file. The file, a device file to the kernel is something the kernel goes, I don't know how to do anything with this unless you teach me. So this is a specific device file which has custom functionality. That means everything for a standard file API has to be written from scratch. What does it mean to open a device file? What does it mean to do a read? What does it mean to do a write? What does it mean to do a close? The kernel doesn't know. So our module has to implement that. We have to teach the kernel what it means to do all the standard file operations for this device. So let's look at it. So if you look here to this code, yeah, you're right, I can't read it either. Let's load it locally. That will be a little easier. Copy location. Okay, so we have that, we have another one, oh, that's fine. So we've got this one here. Let's look through this code. What have we got? So first off, let's go to the bottom. Oftentimes starting code, it was good. So it tells something about the, got some declarations of the license, author, description. I'll talk about this license a little more in a second. There's two things, module init, and module exit. Module init is specifying what function should be called on module when the module is loaded, and what function should be called when we unload the module. And so we define this. This is the function that deregisters it. There's an init one. This is all the init stuff. And then there's these things. Now, We're going to go through all this this stuff and figure out how it works. But what I want to talk about first is this. When you create a device file, you are defining a file that has special semantics. That means file operations do weird things to it. So how do you do that? You define a struct and you provide functions that should be called when things happen. So here we have defined what happens when you open a file, what happens when you read from it, and then there's this release thing. The release thing is saying when you're done with it. It's not a close, because close just means when process is done with it, the kernel may want to cache things or something. So instead you implement release. So now we haven't implemented the other operations. There's no write operation implemented here. So what do you think happens if we try writing to the file? Let's see. So let's echo hello. Permission denied. Oh, this is my local machine. Wrong box. Okay, so you'll notice the permissions on it are read-only. So the permissions don't allow for writing. Well, let's try overriding that. Still gives permission denied. You're just not allowed to do it. Because we did not tell it what to do there, so by default it just says you can't do it. Probably if we tried truncating it. If I tried truncating, let's see. Invalid argument. So you get lots of errors when you try to do things that the module has not specifically had provisions for. If you want the device file to do more interesting things, you have to implement more things here. All you can do is read from it, because that's all we told it how to do. So what was one's release do? One's device closed. Does a print K. What does one's open do? Return zero. Succeeded. What does read do? This actually seems to do something. Who can explain this code to me? Well, first explain, what are we iterating over? What is len? Len, where does this number come from?
The number of bytes to read.
It's number of bytes to read. Who told it the number of bytes to read?
To get it from the inode? What?
From the inode. Nope, not from the inode. It's whoever made the read system call. Whoever made the read system call of read is the one who's in effect calling this. The arguments here are not exactly like those from user space. Like, for example, instead of a file descriptor, which is an integer, here we have a struct file. But similarly, we have a buffer. Now, what are the arguments to read? A file descriptor, a buffer, and a number for how many bytes we want to read. Similarly, we have that here. We have the file, we have the buffer, we have the number of bytes to read, and we have this offset. The offset is here because implicitly in user space, read is always relative to the current position in the file. How do we know what the current position is in the file? We don't unless we're told what it is. That's what the offset is. So this tells you where you are in the file. This is how many bytes to read. This is the file. This is the buffer. That's all it is. This is the kernel space analogs it. It's passed through. It's had a lot of processing in between. And so here we just fill the buffer with ones. Iterate through it, length, put it in there. But this is weird. Why don't we just say buff sub I equals 1? What is this put user? Any thoughts?
You're printing out to the user space, right?
It's going to user space. Specifically, this pointer buff, this buff right here, this is a pointer for a user space process. It is not a kernel buffer. So in order for the kernel to write to user space safely, it does a put user. And the put user takes care of whatever needs to be done to write into that specific process's memory. You might say, well, which process? Well, it's the process that called the system call. There's a lot of mechanism that happens around it when you're programming the kernel that makes things work. And you can't think about all that too much, otherwise you'll go crazy. You just have to kind of think, okay, everyone else has done the work to set things up. I just have to think about this. Here, I just have to think about how to implement read. And I've got this. One last thing I'll talk about this code before going on to other things. Print K. Why not print F? Why do I do a print K? That seems kind of odd. K, you can kind of assume kernel, but why can't I just use regular old printf?
Is it not defined?
Printf is not defined. Let's be more specific. Is the C library available in the kernel? Not at all. The entire C library is not available because the C library depends upon the kernel. So how can you have the C library accessible in the kernel when the C library depends upon the kernel? Anything that looks like it's from the C library inside the kernel is not from the C library. It is the kernel's own implementation. The kernel depends upon no libraries, no external code. Code all belongs to the kernel because it has to stand alone. So we can't do printf because printf, first of all, is not available. But you might say, okay, they're implementing things. Sure, why didn't they just implement printf? Why did they give it a new name? New name implies new semantics. And that's true. Like, for example, if you do string manipulation, you're going to get the length of a string, strlen, is available. It's not implemented in the C library version, but they created their own version inside the kernel. A lot of standard functionality is available. But printf specifically is problematic. Where does printf print by default? No, where does it? It prints to standard out. What is standard out for the kernel? It's not well defined. The kernel is the thing that creates the TTYs that allows you to have standard out in the first place, or allows you to have the files that allow you to have standard out. There is no, the things that you think are available for outputting to don't exist until the kernel creates them. And so what if you want to know what the kernel's doing? You have to have another mechanism to do the equivalent of printfs. They can't go to the terminal. They're going to get to the terminal if they go by another mechanism. So there's an entire infrastructure in the kernel for logging kernel messages. And that's what printk does. So it logs to the kernel log. And the kernel log can get directed to the terminal under some conditions. Otherwise, it gets directed to a file. Let's see, did those messages actually appear anywhere? Well, there they are. You can see here. So we got a couple things. One's device registered. It said something about this. One's module verification failed signature and required key missing tainting kernel. I'll explain that, but basically the way we've got the setup is not very secure. It's supposed to verify the code. We haven't verified this code, so it's annoying, but it let us do it. And then it says one's device registered, that's another print K, and here it is. So the print Ks go to the kernel log. On a standard system, the kernel log goes to var log kern.log. That's where you can see the output of the kernel. Some configurations it will go to the terminal, but if you're wondering what the kernel's doing, look at kernel log. So that was his explanation. Why do you need that? It's because where else would the kernel send its messages? So where I want to end is talking about the Linux cross-reference, which I think... Free electrons. How that works. So this is the Linux kernel cross-reference. Everything that's in here is, it's all here. I mean, you have to go to the right version. Okay, we're running 4.4 something, so technically we're down here. 4.4.88, I think it was saying something like that. So technically we're here, but for most of the things you're looking at, you probably won't notice things that have changed. But if you want to be precise, you know, this is the kernel version we're using. How do we know this? It says 4.4.83. So this is the upstream kernel source. Everything that's there is here. You can look through these files, look through these directories and everything. But if you want to start exploring the Linux kernel source, I highly recommend you go online to one of the Linux cross-references. And that's for a very simple reason. Any file you look at in the Linux kernel source refers to other files. There are so many abstractions. If you can't go between them, you won't know what's going on. So let's start with talking about file operations. What does it mean to do a read and a write? Where are those system calls implemented? Now, we could look to find the exact thing, but we can just navigate the file system and see what's there. So looking at these top-level directories, we're doing something related to files. Oh, there's a directory called FS. File system. So you can go in file system and we can see all these different file systems that are implemented. A lot of file systems. But for now, these are the things that are common to all file systems. And you'll notice here, if you look at this, you'll find files like read, write. And if you look in read, write, it says, look at that copyright date. Trust me, this file has been changed a lot since then. But if you look at this now here, this will, you know, this has the implementations of all kinds of things like seek, you know, generic file lseek size. If we go here, so this is all seeking. Let's see, where's the... VFS iter read, VFS RW verify area, new sync rate, VFS read. This is basically your read thing. VFS stands for virtual file system layer. This is the layer that allows the Linux kernel to say, oh, you want to read from a file, what file system is that part of? If depending upon the kind of file system, I will have to use different code. So abstracts it out into a virtual layer that then redirects it. And so you'll see things like this. This code you should be able to understand, at least in principle. What do you think this is doing? Just these lines right here. So if mode read, if not readable, basically if the file mode is not fmode read, it says bad. You can't do it. Checking permissions. Yeah. It is checking permissions. And this is a common refrain in the kernel, is that before you do the main operation for anything, you do the actual thing, you have to check whether the calling process is allowed to do this. If you don't check, oh man, really? Anyway, no point right now. I'm recording the audio at least. So if the kernel has access to everything, how do you limit access from user space processes? You just check. That gives you an idea of how thin the level of protection is. What happens if there's a bug in this code? What if you don't do the permission checks right? All of a sudden now, processes are allowed to do things that they should not be allowed to do. That's bad.
Mm-hmm. So if I modify the kernel and remove the permission check and make a new kernel, will it be able to read files it's not allowed to read?
Yes. Yes, if you install, modify the kernel and hack the kernel so that you eliminate the permission checks, you can easily make it so that a regular user can read any file they want or change any file they want without changing anything in user space. And that's, in fact, what you can do by loading a module, because you can override these functions. You can create your own versions of these functions so that these things don't work. This is what it means that you need to keep the kernel secure for your system to be secure, because the kernel is the part that enforces everything. That's why messing with modules is dangerous. But all it is, when you say, what enforces the permissions? It's just a little bit of code. And this code is everywhere in the kernel. Anytime you're given some operation, they have to very carefully add in this. Do you think there are ever bugs? Yes. This is why kernels should be updated regularly and why Android is horrible. They don't update their kernels. Bad Android. Almost all Android devices. So this is a permission check. And then we have something that's saying, well, can you actually read that part of it? What does that read? Now, so I make a like, what is RW verify area? I don't know what that does. I can click on it. And it tells you it's defined in these two files and referenced in four files. So it's defined here. Okay, click on that. And now the verifier area doesn't like huge counts. We limit them to something that fits in an int so other people won't have to do range checks all the time. Okay. So it's doing some stuff for checking whether stuff. I don't quite know. But you might go like, well, what is, oh, it's calling inode gets file inode. What is that? This tells you this. It's defined in one file. Okay, it's defined here. Inode is struct inode file. It's an inline function that just returns f inode.
Hmm? What does it mean when it says unlikely?
Ah. When it says unlikely like this? So what unlikely is indicating for optimization purposes that this branch is not likely to be taken. And so optimize this as the uncommon path. Do the rest as the common path. You have lots of little things in the kernel that are optimization tricks that try to not impede the readability of the code. And this is one of them. How does unlikely work? I'm not sure. I think it might be a macro, or it might be a compiler directive. I don't know. But again, this gets to the build environment. There's a lot of magic happening under here. You think you understand this little bit of code? There's all kinds of crazy things going on. But the basic semantics of what's happening at any given point is clear, is much clearer, because you see, okay, this is the flow of the logic. But some of these things are magic. Like, what is this unlikely doing? I know what the semantics of it are. How it does it, I'm not sure. I mean, but I could look it up. And then, okay, it's like here, let's get the permissions. Now is verifying the manage. So one thing to also look, so, and then the other cool thing to look at is this. When you see this, so this is the file. This is the file operations. This is the read. So this is how our read function will get called. It will check to see if it exists, and then it will be called by this. So somewhere, someone has figured out that took this redirection, but that's how our code gets called. I do not expect you to understand all this. I do not understand all this, as it should be clear. It's a very complicated bit of code. What I am hoping for you to do in the last part of this course is for you to start doing little things with the kernel. And my real goal is for you to, again, expand your mental model of how systems work, and then also to realize that it's all code. Some code is more complicated than other, but at the end of the day, it's just code, and you can modify any of it, especially, you know, if you have the appropriate access. And even if not, there are ways around it. I will stop here, and we will see you on Thursday.